5 years, and a lot of people, when I began photographing hip-hop, they thought I was a loon because they said that music is jungle music and it'll never do anything, etc., etc. But anybody who's ever done anything, there's always someone to tell you why you shouldn't do it, so you should ignore them. Bambaataa is a friend of mine and a brother. Last night we did the UK premiere of my film, which won all the awards in the United States, called The Other Side of Hip-Hop. And we're using that film to educate, uplift, and empower young people, and also to decriminalize hip-hop, but not to preach, but to educate and lift up, because there's a whole lot of things that we can do with hip-hop as a vehicle for communication rather than as a vehicle for y'all just to shake your ass or smile at, you know, the latest stupidity that comes through the microphone. I'm going to leave right now, but I just want to tell you all that if you had been there last night, you would have heard some very inspiring words, but you also would have heard some scary words. I almost didn't make it this time because of the volcano in Iceland. Prior to that, they had a huge earthquake in China, and prior to that, they had one in Chile, and so on and so forth. Right now, Memphis, Tennessee, which is the home of rockabilly and so many forms of music, is under 3 feet of water. 2 weeks ago, they had a snowstorm, which was twice my height. And, you know, they didn't even put it in the newspaper. There's calamities and all kinds of things. So we need to use that spiritual, mental, and the powers that we have, because the governments don't work. That's what 2012 is about. It's not about Martians and, you know, the sky falling. It's about all the systems that exist. And our holy men, native holy men, have always told us that their time is up. And all the lies, your Thatchers or whoever, even Obama's full of shit, because he took president, he became president, had the whole world, everybody got an erection, women were foaming at the mouth, oh, Obama. There's two wars going on that's costing $10 billion a month, which is about 17 billion pounds a month for two wars to kill people. Innocent men, women, children, and babies. And that prick is not doing a goddamn thing about it. So, you know, to me, Obama is just another shit stain. I'm sorry to use that language. But if you got two wars going on and you're worried about it, simply put, we need to start finding alternate ways to feed ourselves, survive ourselves, and find a way to get past this. Right now, I don't know if you're aware of it, Texas, Louisiana, Florida are about to get deluged with oil. A million barrels a day. I don't know if you know what a million, I don't know what a million of anything is. And a million barrels a day from British Petroleum, BP, your people, okay? And it's going to make an ecological disaster of biblical proportions, and people are still walking around with their, you know, worrying about what tattoo they're going to get. Art should disturb you. Art should empower you, and art should make you think, feel, and most of all, be guided to some kind of action. I'm not going to tell you to be a communist or a terrorist or a Martian. I don't care what you do, as long as you do something that's progressive and positive and use that love that we have here as artists and use it somehow to help feed people. We got old people that are eating cat food. There's a lot of things. I don't want you all to be Mother Teresa. That's bullshit. Have your drink, kiss one another, enjoy one another. But goddamn it, use some of that energy. I'm not, you know, anti-anything. But use some of that energy and don't depend on your government. Don't even think about your government. Like Banksy, you know, you just diss him and to me, Banksy's a hero. They should have a park named Banksy Park because he just disrespects all that shit. I'm not telling you to disrespect it. I'm telling you to ignore it and find an alternative. We have enough love, enough intelligence, and enough everything as artists and as human beings to change it. Thank you.
That's your damn good mic you got there.
It is.
It's pretty,
yeah. It's whether or not it actually delivers the results, yeah. Which is the, as I'm no sound engineer, as I'm no sound engineer, Mike, you might want
to... Listen, don't look at me. You know, I'm on that side of the mic, not the other side.
Side of the mic,
and
yeah.
I'm like, you know... I mean, it's like I've been shown any round. I mean, I've had like a promoter, manager's head on this week almost, but yeah. You know, I mean, only because of any of my friends.
Don't believe that next week he's going to wear a shiny suit and a skinny tie. You watch. I've corrupted him. He's going to
sell an Ernie Prince. Forging his signature. Yeah. All that shit, you know?
He's selling out to the opposition. He's going to be there with the lizard people, you know, in about a week.
There were lots of lizard people there last week.
Yeah.
We saw a greeting card and it said she had the face of a saint. Saint Bernard. So I thought of the royal family, you know, and how they all so saint. They all look like saints.
You're gonna have to forgive me because I've been really busy with family stuff and there's been lots of stuff going on, so I've missed most of Sound City. So I'm not even sure what it is. What is it?
I play nude guitar.
Nude guitar.
Yeah, I just go out on stage.
Should we do this? Not now, but you know we can. You know we can pass it over that you do nude guitar. We can.
It's actually good on the radio because you can't see it. It's not a pretty. It's not a pretty sight. Trust me. I make sure one of the rules is there's no mirrors in the house. So you know, no, I'm a photographer and I'm a hip hop photographer and I'm the only man on the planet who for 35 years has documented all five elements of hip-hop. I am a photographer, an activist, and on the World Council of the Universal Zulu Nation, honorary member of the Black Panther Party, and one of the only three members, honorary members of the Nation of Islam. And of the three, I'm the only one of the three with a sense of humor. and I'm a Buddhist, and I have a sense of detachment also, but I am a documenter. My work has been published around the world. I have 12 books and a movie which has won countless awards, and we just had the UK premiere, and Mike actually is the one, I shouldn't have said it, but he's going to be doing nude guitar soon. You know, because it just adds another dimension, not a large one, but some a little
huge dimension.
Oh God! God, that's really impressive.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm
what about the nude guitar?
No, I'm quite taken aback.
I'm the only man on this earth. I'm also Native American, Buddhist, and the only man on this earth who has documented all five elements for 35 years, and has also become part of the culture. Afrika Bambaataa came here to Liverpool out of friendship for me. He was doing gigs in Spain. He didn't have to come here, and. You know, I have that respect universally, and I've also been, and I'm saying this humbly, a positive influence on hip-hop and on three or four generations of young people to get them to aspire to the arts. So that's who I am. And humor is something we need. It's like lubrication. And nothing from lovemaking to machines works without lubrication. So I do have a sense of humor. But I'm also somewhat feared in the country because I do have a clear voice. And people know that generally if they come to me and ask me to speak, that I'll speak truth to power. So the authorities, people have asked me, aren't you afraid of them monitoring you and watching you? And I said no, because they do that to all Americans.
Mm-hmm.
They've just gotten so paranoid now that they do it to everyone. There was a time where we were an isolated group that threatened the establishment or was perceived to threaten. As a Buddhist, I don't believe in, you know, that harming and blowing up things. And revolution is a circle. Revolution means to go in a circle, to revolve. I don't believe in that. You have to change people's hearts, and you do that through music and art and love. It's a whole different thing. And that's just a little bit, thank you, a little bit about me. But now, there was a time where, you know, that FBI jacket was scary, but now everybody in America has one. You know, they even spy on each other. So now it's a badge of honor. It's almost, it's meaningless, because they had, according to my teaching, 6,000 years, and their time is up.
Yeah.
That's what 2012 really is. It's the end of their lizard rule, as Ike would say. I don't believe in lizards, but they are lizard-like.
Yeah.
And their behavior is definitely lizard-like.
And you wonder how a man that I used to work for, Rupert Murdoch, who I've taken pictures of when I worked, he took over the radio station and TV station I was working at. And you wonder how a man like that gets so much power and adds absolutely nothing to the earth, and yet plunders the earth. And you wonder how could that be, and how can a royal family and all, you know, the billionaires and the Pope and all these people, what is the connection and how do they get that power? And these are the questions that we need to ask, and we need to not be complacent about 5 million cameras.
Yeah.
And we need to not be complacent over the abuse of power and the spying and the mythology of terrorism. To a woman with two kids and no money coming in, terrorism has a different face. It's the choice between paying rent or buying food. That's terrorism. Mm-hmm. Terrorism is a kid that doesn't have a job and doesn't know what to do and joins the army and gets his balls blown off in Afghanistan in a war that makes no sense. Terrorism is where they're closing schools and hospitals and libraries to pay $10 billion a month for two wars that make no fucking sense in any way, shape, or form. They say the terrorists came from there. What if they came from France? What if they came from Liverpool?
Yeah. Then we would we be, yeah, we wouldn't be on their hit list next, would we?
So I'm an artist, but I think that art is supposed to disturb, inform, challenge, and inspire. You're supposed to, art is supposed to be, as an artist, you're supposed to not answer questions. You're supposed to not even form questions. You're supposed to make people want to ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
You're supposed to be in a point where you say, wait a minute. This does not make sense. This does not fit. Why should I be beholden to anyone? Why should, you know, just if you give me a newspaper, I'll show you all the shit that does not make sense. This is non-logical. This is non-human. This is non-life. This, you look at a newspaper and you say, does it give life or take life? What is this? What is it? And you learn to reread. Art should make you be able to read.
To be able to read through the lines of the newspaper, to be able to see what the deeper story is.
It should be able to make you read life. And the newspapers, I've worked on newspapers. I worked at the New York Post before Rupert Murdoch took that over. It should ask questions, and you should provide the answers. Now the newspapers provide answers and ignore the questions.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that stuff is made up. It's not real. And I've been at these events, and then you read the article, and you were at the event, and I have the photos, and it's two different animals.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're in a strange time. And who was it? Said Orwell?
Yeah, yeah.
He warned us about all this.
Mm.
The wars in Patagonia or wherever, you know, the endless wars.
Mm-hmm.
Between that and 1984, we were warned. We were told. There was a whole blueprint. Unfortunately, we ignored it in the lizards read it and followed it to the T. Pick up 1984 and read that. It's a short book. It's not, you know, it's not a, you know, like a Dickens novel that's 1,200 chapters. You know, it's small. But 1984 and Brave New World are the blueprints for what's happening now, especially in the UK. And now the mayor of New York is coming to the UK, or is here, or is coming, and he wants to find out about the cameras because they want to put more cameras.
Mm-hmm.
If it was for me, I would take away all the cameras.
Yeah.
Except mine. Cameras, I use my camera as a weapon, not as a spy thing. Mine is a weapon of information and enlightenment. And for cameras to be, you know, why do people have to watch me all the time? And I don't think it's really reduced crime at all. They say it has, but who really makes the statistics? I don't believe it. I don't believe in cameras. And we're going to get into a world, if we have 5 million cameras now and all those people watching, just with anything, even in a relationship with you and a woman, ask what's it going to be like in 10 years. If she's intolerable now, what's it going to be like in 10 years? If your child is 5 and he's possessed by the devil now, what's it going to be like when he's 15? You know, so I don't mean possessed literally. And if we have 5 million cameras in the UK right now, what's it going to be like in 10 years, 15 years? Think about that. think about the level of intrusiveness. You may have to take a urine sample each morning, or have a DNA test, or have your stool analyzed. I mean, you know, where would it stop? If they have the right to photograph you all the time. I'm a godfather to Malcolm X's grandson. And Malcolm's daughter, Gamilla, lives on a corner house. And right outside her window, they put a camera. Mm-hmm. Right outside her window. It's right on the post, right outside her window. She called me to her house one day and said they put a camera out there. And it's one of those round cameras that photographs everything. She has to keep her window shut to keep them from looking. That's Malcolm X's granddaughter.
Yeah.
Daughter, rather. And, you know, I thought about that. I said, wow, what if Malcolm X were here to see a camera put in his daughter's, you know, window? And then I began to read more about the cameras, and it became more and more bizarre. And people, what they do is, it's the theory of the camel. They never take and put 5 tons of straw on the camel. They put, you know, until the point where the camel's back breaks. And that's what they're doing. They didn't put up 5 million cameras overnight. They do a little bit. And ask yourself, make a projection. What is it going to be like in 10 years? Ask that question. Literally, just ask it on the air. If they have that level of invasiveness now, and what do they do with these pictures? Even at the airport, I want to go to, you know, Poland. Why do I have to go through that? You know, why do I have to go through an x-ray machine? And what level of damage is that doing to me on a cellular level? And why do they have to do that? I am on record as being against violence and harming people and hurting children. And, you know, the idea of the Islamic terrorists blowing up daycare centers, I mean, or the Palestinians, or even the Israelis, that's barbarism. That's not even, I can't even call it animalism, because animals, I love animals, and animals know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're predatory to eat, not for sport, mostly. And, you know, I ask all these questions, and you have to ask, at what level do we begin to start thinking past the colonizer's mentality and that war? And people say, well, you're anti-war. I said, well, yes, but I'm not going to stand out there and burn a flag or hold up a protest sign. I want to use this to not even give answers, but to ask the questions and to look around. And one of the questions literally is, if they have 5 million cameras now and that level of control now, what's going to happen in 10 years and 15 years and 20 years? Where's it going to go? And how, if we can't stop it now, at what point is it going to be unstoppable? Or have we already reached that tipping point?
Really interesting questions. Really interesting questions. It is that, it is everyone, there has been campaigns, you know, across Britain to control the number of CCTV cameras. And sometimes arts groups will, they do performances in front of them and various different things just to highlight the fact that there are CCTV cameras, you know, and continually to intrude in people's lives. But I'm quite shocked to hear that they stuck a camera right outside Malcolm X's daughter's house, and yeah, what would Malcolm do about that now?
Well, there's another question another question is not just stopping the cameras. The cameras are a symptom of an illness. If you have boils on your neck, that's not an illness. That's a symptom of an illness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have liver spots or your tongue is turning green, those are symptoms. And the cameras are not an illness. The cameras are symptomatic of an illness. And the illness is to control and spy. And stopping the cameras is only part of it. They have to stop the mentality that goes beyond it. And that's where art and art projects come in, to stop that mentality. We don't need to be watched. We're not, little microbes or bacteria. We don't need to be watched. We're human beings. And we've been able to live for many, many hundreds of thousands of years on this earth without being watched. He took me to see standing stones. Imagine if people had cameras there and tell them, well, what are these guys doing with those rocks? You know, it looks subversive to me. You know, why are they building Stonehenge? Why are they building all these grains? What are they doing? Why are they making topiaries? What are these people? You know, that's nobody's business. And these are the questions. Unless we ask questions, we can't begin to get the answers. And you have to start. I told Mike that I have something that the people in Liverpool don't have when they come here. And that's fresh eyes. I see things anew. Like if you come to my country or my area, you'll see things that I'm blind to because I've seen them my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike, I come to Liverpool and you have to see the wealth of imagery that I've done in the last few days. It's whatever, so 10,000 pictures, 12,000 pictures, literally, literally. You know, I've filled up memory cards and my images, some are very loving, some are very warm, and some are startling because I have fresh eyes. But you bring that when you go to a new place. And you have to analyze the illness. Why? And first, what makes them feel that they have the authority to spy on you? Second, what type of voyeuristic thing? Who are these people sitting behind the camera? What do they do with that film footage? And don't tell me, oh, they destroyed it after 30 days. Horse crap. They may keep that forever. What are they doing with it? And who are these people? And how do you protect against them? And you know, at what level do they go from being watchers to taking proactive steps? And you know, you have to ask a bunch of questions. And I'm not here to give answers. I'm here, you know, to see. And even in my country, there's things that I don't understand. And I speak against. So I'm perceived as a threat. And they say that capability and intent equal threat. So in my country, when I speak out, people get very nervous because I'm a unique individual in that I've been in their military. I was in their military for 6 years. I've been in their wars. Mm-hmm. I've been in their schools. I've been in their education system. And I'm also outside their system. And I'm a Native American, which means that I have roots in the earth before the Europeans came. So I'm a unique individual in that I have all these influences. And then the Creator gave me the ability to see past. And then gave me the ability to document. And then gave me the ability to speak. That's a strange mix. My film was just introduced in the UK. The first night they had two screenings. They had to turn people away both nights. And then we did a Q&A with Bambaataa, who people think of as a DJ. That's a tool. He's a visionary. I showed Bam some of the communications I get from him. They're 50 years ahead of where we are now. So that's what I bring here.
Yeah, they've been up there for 25 years. Wow. Since they left Roby, you know, which was my family home when I, you know, in Titan.
Yeah.
We were going into the park yesterday morning and he was upset at me because I saw some holes in the ground. Are those badger holes? And he was...
Everybody knew they were rabbits. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
He's so quick to point the finger, you know.
I told him in Wisconsin, Madison I know because I did lectures there. There's a very progressive college there. And I was wearing red. I had got this red sweat outfit and it was really bright, it was nice. And I was doing a lecture and I didn't want the kids to fall asleep, so I had all red. I'm walking out and all of a sudden like these armies of people came and they're hugging me and giving me beer and food and everything. And I was like, you know, I was looking around and there was like a sea of people in red. I was like, and I tried to understand, I was talking to them, and what it is that their team is the Badgers. It's, you know, it's a big,
yeah, yeah.
And I didn't know what a badger was. And they showed me a picture. I said, it's like a beaver. They said, no, it's a badger. And they were explaining to me what a badger was. I didn't know what a badger was. And we're having this conversation on the street and there's young kids, teenagers, and old folks, and they're all together and they saw all these people. So more people were coming and they were explaining to me. And I was like, so fascinated. But if he ever goes to Madison, Wisconsin, he might be considered a local hero, you know.
But I'll be wearing blue, of course.
Yeah.
No, you don't want to wear blue there. Right? No, not in Madison.
I don't like fitting in.
No, no, no. You don't want to wear blue in that town. You won't be able to get food, gasoline for your car. No, there. Madison, Wisconsin is badger territory. And when we get back, I want you to go on the internet and look up the team for, and it might be all of Wisconsin. I don't know how. Mm-hmm. But Madison, man, I had read they were, you know, they were just giving me food and, you know, they wanted me to go to the game. Wow. One guy even offered me tickets, but I had a lecture at the same time. And I had, and you know, I couldn't believe how friendly they were. And it was just by dumbness that I had on red. It was one of those cosmic jokes on me, you know. But badges, man. I didn't know what a badger was.
Well, they're black and white, not red. They shouldn't
be. Yeah, exactly.
I'm not sure what a badger is, but they're little furry things that dig in the ground and eat bugs.
They only come out at night, so you've never seen them.
Yeah, that's what I've never seen. This is the first time I've ever seen them in the day.
They bite police officers' fingers in Thunderheart with John Trudeau. When you put the hand in there.
Yeah, that's right. I remember.
The badger bites his finger.
I love that movie.
Yeah.
I love that movie. Val Kilmer is such a great actor. You know, he played Elvis in a movie, but you barely see him in True Romance. Have you ever seen that?
Not sure.
It's a great movie. It's Tarantino. Tarantino Unleashed.
Yeah.
And it's called True Romance. And it's a very simple story. Gary Oldman's in it. He plays a Rastafarian. It was right around the time he did Dracula. He plays a Rastafarian. He plays a white kid who thinks he's black, who's a Rastafarian. He's a drug dealer and he's a bad man. And the movie, you watch it and you can't take your eyes off it. You're transfixed. But that Val Kilmer plays Elvis Presley. And people watched the movie and I said, did you like Val Kilmer? I didn't see Val Kilmer. Val Kilmer is Elvis Presley. And Elvis keeps appearing to the main character,
mm-hmm.
giving him guidance and talking. That's Val Kilmer in a gold suit. Strange movie. True Romance.
So have you been doing many talks while you've been over here? So you did one as part of Sound City.
The only talk that I did was the Q&A after my movie. And the Bambaataa and I, in the film, we do a talk together.
Yeah.
And then the only time that we've done a talk together was in 2001, 2002, I believe, at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center. It was called A Conversation with the Elders. And I think the room held 150 people, and we expected maybe 100, and we had about 800.
Oh my God.
And before we went out to speak, we were in a room together and we had our energy straight, we prayed, and then I asked him, I said, Bam, how far can we go? You know, because in all forms of teaching and all forms of everything, there's circles. There's the broader circle, there's the inner circle, and then there's the just, you know, the wizard circle, so to speak. So you have, and he looked at me with that great face and he said, as far as you want. And I felt a tingle through my whole body because we had never done that. And we were just going to go where it led us. And fortunately, unfortunately, the people that were conducting it kept it pretty superficial on music and art, and you know, they didn't go too deep. But Bambaataa is definitely a visionary, and Bambaataa in our communications and in the inner circles of the Zulu Nation, it's almost like every day I learn more and more and more and more and more. And it's not mystical, feel good, you know, holistic, hold your breath and meditate. No, it's about living on this planet and galactic and intergalactic things, and you know, a lot of questions about survival. There's a lot of things in there. And even though, you know, I've studied so many things, there's so many things that he presents us with information. And we have chapters in every country in the world, but people think of the Zulu Nation in terms of music and DJing and bouncing on your head, but it's a whole lot deeper. But you have to become an initiate, and that takes time. And unlike other schools, you know, we don't, it's not like martial arts where you get a white belt, a blue belt, a green belt, a polka dot belt. No, this is only a few people allowed in the inner circle, and we share that information and we try to disseminate it in music and different forms, but gently, because not everybody's ready for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not everybody's ready for everything. People are, right now they're caught on the economic thing. You know, the powers that be, the lizards, have kept us just trying to, you know, put gas in our car and food in our stomachs, so they've kept us on that level. And there's a reason for that. And that's why the music is getting dumber and dumber. The art is getting dumber and dumber. And unfortunately, hip-hop has compelled people not to read books. You know, you can get it all on YouTube or get it from a sound bite.
Yeah.
And even the politicians are smart enough just to cater to that sound bite. And rather than discuss anything of value. So we're beginning to believe that politicians, it's not like before where we'd have a revolution and cut off their heads or put them in, you know, jail. No, we're just sidestepping them, let them do their buck dancing and, you know, hucklebuck, and we just walk around them, you know. I think John Lennon, he showed me a video, I think John Lennon was aware of about 20 years ago, where, you know, he was talking about not actually confronting them, just ignoring them, like monkeys in a zoo, let them babble, hurt each other, you know, but don't let them out of the cage. Now you got these two gentlemen there. What's their name? Heckle and Jekyll or Hickle and Pickle. And they look like cousins. And I watched them the other day on BBC in the hotel. I was laying in the bed in the Hilton. I'm watching. I said, whoa, these guys are buffoons. It's like George Bush and his idiot brother, you know, I was watching.
Yeah.
And I'm listening to this babble, and I'm like, holy mackerel, the English people are dumb enough to listen to this? This is 2010, that's 1954.
Yeah.
You know, you've had, you know, a half a century of stupidity. You know, we've had a half a century. The beginning of this century, till now, has been one of the most painful and horrible periods in human history, starting in September 11, 2001. Ask my wife, I had a vision there. We were up there, it was my daughter's birthday, August 18th. We go to the top of the World Trade Center because there's a little club she hung out at called Windows on the World. And it was August 18th, it was right after midnight. We go up there, and she asked me to dance, and I start to dance with her, and I saw fire and dead people, and I thought I was back in war, and I started crying. So, you know, we were all dressed up, and it was her birthday, and, you know, women spend all day getting their hair done and everything, and, you know, I totally panicked, and they've never seen me cry. I was crying, and I saw the whole thing, and I started banging on the elevators, and I told them, the elevators don't work, we're run down. It's the 110th floor. Of course, 3 weeks later, that thing happened, and they called me, and they knew that I had seen it. And then you had the tsunami. And then you've had the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Mm.
Then you had the Israeli, Palestinian thing festering like a sore. And you had Katrina. And then the last few weeks we've had China, Puerto Rico, Chile, Haiti. You know, it's like the thing in Iceland is kicking up. And if you look from the beginning of the new century till now, it's been like a horrible hologram, and people are just not putting it together, and they don't realize. And it's just been one thing after another, and Somalia, and, you know, Darfur. And, you know, it's on and on and on. And if you really look at it from the point of view of history, of horrible things, it's like they're accelerating rather than, you know, there's always been a sporadic, but now it's just like picking up. and they got people so crazy over just trying to feed themselves. In the States, we have foreclosures that are going on like, it's like madness. So people are worried about keeping a roof over their head. They got people so crazy. Now we have, and my numbers are different than the government's numbers. There are 300 million people in the United States. They say they have a 9.9% unemployment. 10% of 300 million is 30 million. But the truth is that they're only monitoring those people who are seeking employment. So imagine, and I know nobody in this room can imagine the number because I can't, 35 million people in the United States with no form of income. You have the summer coming up. You have $10 billion a month pissed away on two illegal wars.
Mm.
You have, in the United States, and where I'm from, you have the Crips and Bloods, two violent gangs that are growing at an alarming rate. You have crime statistics. You have an epidemic of crystal methamphetamines that are literally eating people's brains. You have not only joblessness, but hopelessness. You have foreclosures. You have a disaster in the brewing. They're closing firehouses, schools, libraries. Near me, they just laid off 3,000 teachers in California, where Schwarzenegger is the governor. Think how fucking insane that is. They laid off 22,000 teachers. That's a number I can't wrap my head around. It takes you 6 years to study, or 4 years to study to become a teacher. It takes you 10 years to become a good teacher. To lay off 22,000 in my area, which is far smaller, 3,000 teachers. They're laying off teachers because they need to feed the war machine. And the news is focusing on who had breast implants. It's you know,
madness.
Yeah. And people are not putting, you know, intelligence to me is connecting the dots. And people are not, you know, when you were a kid, they give you to connect the dots, you make the little bunny rabbit.
Yeah.
People don't know how to connect the dots anymore.
With this, isn't this the kind of thing where, you know, where you mentioned earlier that you were, the newspapers, they just, you know, they're just presenting lies to you. They're not, you know, there's no truth in them. Isn't it, you know, they're not investigating those kind of stories and pushing those stories to the front page. It is the so-and-so's had her boobs done, so-and-so in this outfit or that outfit. It's all very, you know, there's nothing
they
to it.
They just had something on the BBC about this cow that was married to David, what's his name? The redhead, what's her name?
Fergie, yeah.
They just had a big thing.
We don't care. We don't care. Let them get on with that. We want to hear some. We want proper investigative journalism. We want to be presented with the facts. We want to find out about schools that are being closed, about teachers that are being laid off. We want to know how that's going to affect our lives.
How are we going
to
stop the war in Afghanistan and Iraq? You had President Eisenhower in the United States, who was a general and who was famous for always being seen playing golf, and kind of, he looked, you know, very patriarchal. He looked very nice. He had the gray, you know, balding hair, and, you know, he was very nice. But what happened was, if you go on the internet, you'll see speeches that this man made about the term that he created called the military-industrial complex.
Mm.
And that same very grandfatherly looking guy, and kind of, you know, dodging, he's playing his little golf, and he becomes a different person. He becomes very clear, and he's talking about the threat of the military-industrial complex and how when they get together and form, you know, these unimpeachable things that, you know, he warned about them. Watch him, don't listen to me. He was the president. Listen to, watch and watch his body language and look at his eyes. And he warned about this thing that he calls the military or whatever. No, it is greater than that. It's an entity. It's at the core of it, what Ike, you know, in his lunacy calls the lizards. But watch Dwight David Eisenhower, the president, talk about the military-industrial complex, and look at Truman warn about the things, and then look at the different presidents talk about the Federal Reserve Bank. And when I go to colleges, I ask people, I said, what part of the federal government is the Federal Reserve Bank? and the parts of the government are the judicial, the executive, and the legislative. That's the only three parts of the government. And the way they were formed was to keep each other in check so that none, neither the Supreme Court, the president, nor the legislative bodies can, you know, control it to such a point that anyone, so it's a brilliant idea which was taken from the Native American Federation originally. Mm-hmm. And it's a brilliant set of checks and balances. So I asked, since this, Federal Reserve Bank has so much power, which of the three branches is it part of? Now the Justice Department, which is, you know, there, controls the banks, supposedly, and controls the laws of the banks and the FBI and so. So I just give them that. I said, what part of the federal government is the Federal Reserve Bank, which controls everything about the economics? And very, very few even venture to guess. This is at colleges. And then they all give the wrong answers. The truth is, the Federal Reserve Bank is no part of the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
It's a separate entity. It's 12 banks ruled by, you know, the consortium of. And if they don't understand that, and they're in college, and they don't even understand the workings of their own government, well, you have the Federal Reserve Bank, and you have other outside agencies, and you have in the United States the NSA, which is the National Security Agency, which is above the law, because it's not beholden to any of those three. And then you have other organizations above that, until you have just the hands. And I don't have to tell you that. You can find that out. But people don't talk about that. Once a year, they have the Bilderberg meetings. You know about the Bilderbergs?
No.
Write down the word Bilderberg. Once a year, all the leaders of the world meet, and not one press person in the world videotapes it, reports on it. Now imagine, just if Obama came to the UK, it'd be in the news. If Gordon Brown or whoever, whichever twiddly dumb goes to China, you know, imagine if the leaders of the world, from China to the United States, the UK, everything else, has a meeting, and the press doesn't even talk about it. You'd say, wow, that sure reeks of a conspiracy. That sure reeks of something very bad. But if you go on the internet, you'll see not only do they meet, who's there, but footage by people like Banksy,
mm-hmm.
you know, these underground videographers that actually have footage of these people, you know, that go and give the world this great image of, you know, whatever, you know, they got the nice polished, you know, everything, but they have the meetings and nothing's reported by the media. So you say, wait a minute, that's the power elite, and they're controlling the media, then maybe we don't have what we think we have, and maybe democracy is a joke. Maybe there's another thing at you know, working. David Icke has a great idea that they're all lizards, you know.
Not sure about the purple suit, sir.
Well, I actually think that they're more like worms than lizards, but worms actually have a purpose. I've yet to see a rationale for what these people do. But look it up, Bilderberg. And yeah, in the States, I'm kind of, you know, I watch myself. I don't drink, I don't smoke. I've had one woman for 35, 33 years. You know, I live, you know, very clean. I have no weapons in the house. There's nothing they can find, you know, until thought becomes illegal, you know. Not that that's ever stopped anybody from doing anything, but I think that what tempers it is the fact that I'm, you know, resolutely against violence. So they can't even bring that in and accuse me of, you know, that. And because I don't believe in drugs at all, other than as a scourge of, you know, mankind, they can't say, they can't link me to that, you know. And, you know, they get you with all kinds of things in the States for, you know, everything. But if you're above that, mm-hmm. to the point, and not only that, but you're publicly above that. So it's not like, you know, I'm against drugs, but I'm doing drugs on the low now. So it's very hard for them to get me for anything, but they would like to. But like I said, most people are so consumed or subsumed just with getting from Monday to Tuesday that I'm not really perceived, I don't think, as a threat. Not completely as a threat, more as an artist. But I think it's time we start really, really, really looking more closely at the world around us and getting past how can we rule everything and control everything and get into a mode where we say, in the last few days, he's taken me all over the UK. Mm-hmm. And I'm astounded because I've never seen so much green in my life. And I was really confused about how do you guys keep all that grass cut everywhere I go. Even the top of the hedges, he says they have machines that get the top. You know, because I do a little bit of gardening, I'm exhausted, you know. So here's, you know, acres and acres, hundreds of acres. So what that teaches me is that there's vast amounts of land, and I've been to Brazil, I've been all over the world. So we have no shortage of land. And the truth is, with that land, we can grow crops. So we have no shortage of food. But why are people hungry and why are people homeless when we have vast areas of land? And why are people suffering when we can put these people to work growing crops, mm-hmm. to feed themselves and to generate some form of income? And now, as we go around, I see solar things and windmills. So we don't have to, you know, you see what happened in the south coast of the United States with the BP, the oil.
Yeah.
They're saying 1 million gallons a day. Again, I'm a simple man. This is one glass, this is one bottle. I can't think of 1 million glasses or 1 million bottles, but 1 million gallons a day. And that's just one more catastrophe, and that's gonna have an ecological disaster on our fish, shrimp, barrier reefs,
mm-hmm.
the water. And one thing that they haven't talked about that I found out when I was in the Navy, you see this here, this can be a powerful weapon, not used to hit somebody, but if you aim it a certain way, you can create fires from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Just a piece of glass, people don't know. And what's happening, and they haven't talked about it, is that Katrina, now this is going to shock you. Katrina was caused by 1 degree variation in the temperature of the water. Look it up. Don't take my word for anything. I may be a crazy person. 1 degree change in the temperature of the water. And off the west coast of California, 1 degree change creates what's known as El Nino,
mm-hmm.
which is the shift in the craziness of the water patterns. 1 degree temperature created a superstorm, which was Katrina, which devastated Louisiana and Alabama and Mississippi. What happens is if you allow the oil to sit on the water, it reflects the sun back,
mm-hmm.
and it causes temperature shifts. Mm-hmm. And as that oil becomes like a film, it's gonna create temperature shifts, and it's gonna create super, especially around Florida, which is hurricane prone.
Mm-hmm.
All you have to do is shift with that oil the temperature of the water by 3 degrees. They're not talking about that. But that's just what I learned when I was in the Navy, and you know, just watching the temperature shift 1 degree. Imagine 3 degrees of temperature.
Right then.
You still want to talk about hip hop?
There's a lot there, isn't there?
There's a rule about your body,
yeah.
and your mind. And I'm 63 years old, and I've been in martial arts for many years. And there's a rule that your mind and your body, whatever you don't use, you lose.
Mm-hmm.
So people are not thinking, and if they are, their thought is being channeled into certain, you know, Fergie,
yeah,
or breast implants, or you know, he makes fun. He goes to the States. He said the women there look like they've been in a wind tunnel. You know, yeah. You know, everybody. There's not a line to be seen. You know, these women, 93 years old, and their skin looks like, you know, skin of an apple. You know, and he jokes about that. But if you don't use this, you lose it. It's very simple. I don't care. You know, I'm not saying that we got to be walking around. I laugh and joke more than anybody. Love to dance. Love to eat. You know. I'm not, you know, I'm not a zealot. No, but if you don't use it, you lose it.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing no one could ever accuse me of is not being able to laugh at the irony and the silliness. Without that, you dry up. You become like a prune. You have to laugh, but you have to also use this. This is a gift. This is a gift, and we're not using it. And that scares me. And we're getting into a generation that's illiterate. Or illiterate.
Mm-hmm.
They don't like. Scariest thing that ever happened, I was down in Atlanta, Georgia. I was doing a book signing. And, you know, people coming from everywhere. They love the book. I'm signing books, and, you know, this one kid was standing there, you know, big muscle bound guy, very handsome black guy. And he comes over, you know, he said, "Can I talk to you?" So I tell everybody, "Wait a minute." I was at a Barnes and Noble's, and I go aside. He said, "I want to talk to you." So I said, "Sure." "Love your book." I said, "Thank you." He said, "I looked at the pictures over and over. I love it." I said, "Thank you." And I said, "Do you have a copy?" He said, "No." I said, "Look, let me give you one. You know, just give it to me." Because I thought that was a nice, you know, that's how I am.
Mm-hmm.
He says, "No." I said, "Don't be ashamed. You know, I'm giving you a copy of the book. It's a gift." And the kid's eyes got sad, and he almost made me cry. He says, "I'm not real good with books." And I had a lump in my throat and ruined my whole night. Well, I'm not real good with books.
I'm scared of books.
Yeah. And it left, it was like I'd been punched in the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
"Well, I'm not real good with books." And he wasn't a dumb kid. And, you know, I still haven't processed that, but over the period of time, I realized some kids just, you know, books are almost like being seen in a boy being seen in a dress. And that really upset me, and I remember all these things. I'm not real good with books.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
Powerful. You explains the whole.
Yes.
Everything, yeah.
Did you see Fahrenheit 451? Not Michael Moore, the original.
Yeah, yeah.
Where they're burning books.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had these secret little cults that would hide books under, you know, in the floorboards or something. You remember that?
I read the book.
Yeah, I read the book too. And then I saw the movie. The movie wasn't as good as the book. But it was like they had to hide books under the floorboards or in the attic or, you know, in the animal cages or something.
Still doing China.
Yeah. But here, you know, somehow they've gotten so advanced that they don't even have to take the books away from people.
Yeah.
But this guy had seen all your pictures. He saw them on the internet, presumably.
No, somebody, a friend of his had the book. And I guess, you know, it kind of helped.
Yeah. Brown paper wrapper.
Yeah.
It's sad. Very sad.
Scary. Actually scary, because I'm a father and a grandfather. I have two kids and I have two grandsons. Scares me. And I remember growing up, we didn't have a radio, we didn't have a TV, but my mom would read to me, and I used to have great adventures reading books. Ivanhoe, whatever. I'd read Hiawatha. I read everything, and, you know, I close my eyes and I try to imagine. And even when we had a radio, I would listen to The Shadow and the Sherlock Holmes, and I would see all this stuff. I would just close my eyes. And I remember how excited I was just picking up a book, man, sitting there and reading a book. You know, even if it was, you know, Tarzan, whatever, it was just, I would see the animals and listen to the sounds in my head. And to rob kids of that, give them video games with it, raping people and cutting people's heads off. See, that's another thing. We as adults don't know what's in there, because we're, you know, I don't even know how to turn this thing. Yeah. But I've seen excerpts from it. Holy mackerel, they're raping a girl. They're gang raping in order, Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah.
Do they really?
They cut this guy's, there's a couple that cut the guy's head off and three guys raped a girl.
Yeah, we've got to stop your kids watching.
I didn't know that. No, they don't. They don't watch that shit anyway. But I didn't know that that would be allowed to go through.
I saw excerpts from it. They throw babies in the fires. I mean, you know, virtually anything, and it escapes us.
It's a crime.
No, it's.
I think I get to
entertainment.
It's desensitized,
of course,
isn't it?
To
the reality of this, and so the,
yes,
you know, I mean, I'm
but it's under the radar because if it's in a book, we can see. If it's a magazine, we can see.
Yeah.
If it's in music, we can hear. But we don't know how to get through, you know, the labyrinth.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm sure Rupert Murdoch owns a lot of the video rights to those video games.
But I probably won't be able time to show you if you're going home tomorrow, but I could show you the ugliest building in Merseyside, which is...
It's the Sun Building?
It's the big... It's just a square cube.
You described it. He said it's like a brick.
Of the East Lanks Road.
Yeah.
And that's where
the Sun?
Know, Rupert Murdoch prints all his filthy newspapers, you know. And, it's
that?
By Kirby, you know, by Nosey. You can see it. You can see it. I mean, you can see it. You know, there's lush green everywhere.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
little, you know, there's all lovely Lord Derby's back garden, which is a whole hill and all this. And then next to it, there's just like this cube, which is just speaks volumes. Because how can we fit as much machinery into a building with as little character as possible to peddle and to create money? Basically, you know, I mean, that's what it is, that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, but if you look at the Nazis and you look at all totalitarian regimes, one of the first victims is architecture, and one of the first victims is art. If you look at the grandiose Nazi artwork and, you know, their architecture, that, you know, that's the first thing to go, is architecture, and to make everything look as...
Well, yeah. Well, empirical, really.
Empirical.
You know,
yeah.
they loved their, you know, Hitler loved his classical, because he thought he saw himself as an emperor. You know, you know, but I mean, the truth of the matter is the, you know, the art that he called degenerate, which was like modern art, and the music which he called degenerate, which was jazz, and all that was really, you know, where it was. But his idea of art was just pillars.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Grand mouths,
the
and
grand Teutonic, you know,
and,
yeah.
and these disgusting sculptures,
yeah,
which
yeah.
are just very, very figurative and very, very large,
yeah.
with very big weapons, you know, it sums them up, really, doesn't it?
But then the Volkswagen Beetle did come out of
yeah,
cute little
yeah.
cars,
yeah, and economical. They also had the Chinese. I have books at home. Of Mao's, you know, grandiose posters of the
yeah,
peasants,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah,
that's but
it, yeah.
that's the
so
first thing
to
be
yeah.
sacrificed.
Well,
yeah.
look at Saddam Hussein as well.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they love that, don't they? The aggrandizement of them.
When I was in Italy, I would go past these shops, and they would have heads, bronze heads, and coins, and all this stuff, and Mussolini, because when he was in charge, that was another thing that they started to shift from the Renaissance type imagery to more, you know, but art and architecture suffer greatly, and it's always funny to look at the pictures of Mussolini, you know.
He was hilarious
sculptors.
Anyway.
Oh yeah, but the
sculptors, like one of the
Marx sculptors,
wasn't he?
Oh, yeah.
With power.
Yeah, I've actually seen back then the, I forget who it was, that did an imitation of Mussolini, one of the comedians, I forget who it was, and it was hysterical. And I had never seen him. Then finally I saw a video of him, and I realized the parody was a copy. It wasn't even a parody.
Mm-hmm.
He had this, and Hitler with his, you know.
Was he Chaplin? Because he did The Great Dictator,
yeah.
didn't he?
Yeah, but his was a little bit more subtle. This was
mm-hmm.
someone
was,
else, I'd
well,
say.
That's a funny thing with Charlie Chaplin and Adolf Hitler, isn't it? Because really, that's the yin and yang, I say, because when they both have the same birthday or something, you know?
yeah,
honestly. And you've got one genius artist with a little black moustache, another absolute despicable tyrants who went the other, you know. Mm-hmm.
But one
was given to the earth and one was taken away.
Did Hitler actually have a birthday? I mean, you know.
Yeah.
It sounded like something from Halloween. I don't know. He was showing me around Liverpool that you still have, you know, great areas that are damaged,
mm-hmm.
and left, you know, as a warning against CCTV cameras, but people don't make the connection.
Mm-hmm. Have you taken Sefton Park?
Yeah.
Did you like Sefton Park?
That was the where the fairy glen was. Remember you photographed
the
thing? Yeah, we've done it all, went to call the stones. You've seen the stones in the stones in the park, a different one, in the greenhouse, which is falling to bits, you know.
Oh, they're called the stones.
Yeah,
they're
called
the stones.
Yeah, that's
a
sin.
My kids go to Calderstone School,
yeah.
And half the kids there don't know what the Calderstones is written on their jumper.
Yeah.
You know, but the fact that it's like a 4,000-year-old testimony to the oldest human civilization in this area, you know.
Yeah.
What I mean?
I didn't know that.
No, a lot of people don't know that, you know, because, you know, I mean, we revere our churches, which are 100 years old, more than we do our monuments, which are 4,000 years old, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the symbols on those stones, and the only similarities to some of them are in Brittany, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They've got spirals on them, I think, because they, you know, I'm up on this, and you know, but I've tried to start a campaign with English Heritage to try and do something with them and present them in a more respected
mm-hmm.
way. But in fact, I wanted to put them, try and cause a campaign to get them back to where they were actually
originally,
where they were in that circle on Menlo Avenue. But
so they've just been taken out the ground and put in the old,
yeah,
green
for house. for their protection, because
mm-hmm.
they're 4,000 year old and they're stones and they're vulnerable. Do you know what
yeah.
I mean? But you know, they ain't gonna put them back. But what they could do is they could present them in with a little bit more love and respect.
They got bird droppings on them where
yeah,
they are.
With some nice information panels and
yeah.
And so children or adults or whoever can go there and realise that actually, you know, people have been around this part of the world for quite a while, you know.
Mm.
Not just since it was called the city 800 years ago or whatever,
yeah.
you know, or it was a port or whatever, you know.
Mm.
And that you know, because the only comparable ones are in Anglesey, which are 90 miles to the west, or and then there's the stone circles up in the Lake District, and then there's the all the sites down in, you know, still Wiltshire,
yeah.
Road, you know, where we visited recently. But yeah,
I sent a note or email to a friend of mine, and I told him that I had a great day Sunday, that I'd spent a whole day with the stones. And I told him I took some great pictures, so he wrote back, he said, wow, that must be exciting, you know, and I can't wait to see the pictures. So actually they look better than the stones, trust me.
The younger.
But he introduced me to a guy that was a foreman on the building of the Stonehenge, friend of his that made Probe Records.
Jeff Davis.
He said, yeah, I worked. Yeah, he said, yeah, I worked on them. I believe him, it looks like it, you know, but that was, yeah, let me tell you something again about fresh eyes. Mike told us not to go into Stonehenge. He said, stand by the side of the road. And, you know, I was a little bit taken aback by that, but I trust him. And we got, you know, we're standing by the side of the road and we have a perfect view. And then we saw that there was a queue and all this stuff. And what happened, which is so bizarre, I'm with this guy, Joe, who's like me, you know, he understands. And we're standing there and there's this wooden plank or platform. And then you get off the platform and you kind of walk on the earth. And the first thing, people don't even look at Stonehenge. They reach in their pocket and, hey, Maggie, and from Japan, England, France, all over the world, I'm listening, Italy, I'm listening to all these accents, and kind of like they're looking at it, and Joe, who's more primitive, he said, man, they had enough radiation to cook a chicken, enough microwave to cook a chicken in. And it's so strange. And my memory of Stonehenge is just all these people, first thing they do, hey Margaret, hey Tommy, you know. And instead of savoring the minute
and
enjoying and embracing that,
it's all about tomorrow, isn't it? It's
yeah,
all
about and I'll on my phone and I'll
yeah.
show people that I've been there. So.
Yeah,
and
it's showing the
tomorrow,
you
click,
were
there.
Click.
Yeah.
You know, you were there.
It's a bit like, you know, when you go there, you get, first thing I thought you were going to say, first thing they do is to get the cameras out.
Well, that's
and so they're restricting their view to, you know,
yeah,
the,
that's
yeah.
right.
that kind of a size.
Oh, no, they don't even want to take pictures. Now they're just. And we're standing there for like 15 minutes, he came back to get us, and we were standing there, and we were watching, and I was like, wow, that's really something. And then, you know, I was still a little bit taken aback, I couldn't go in, but then when he drove past the parking lot,
yeah.
it looked like a soccer field full of buses, and
yeah.
we might have still been there, just trying to get out of the parking lot. It's just crazy.
It was, we went there, Annie and Joe took some photographs and experienced it as good as you possibly could.
Yeah.
And then we took off to Avebury, you know, which is this, have you ever been there?
Yeah.
Absolutely, you know, beautiful, beautiful setting. I mean, this was a Sunday afternoon, so there's probably more people there than normal, but
yeah.
we just walked around and had our sandwiches and looked at all the stones.
And it's all ours,
you know,
there's nobody there.
Yeah, there's, you know,
there were more stones than people.
Yeah, and the big, you know, size of this room, some of them, you know, bigger,
nice.
You know. And,
yeah.
I imagine, never been.
Yeah, well, you got to take like Silbury Hill, West Kennet, Long Barrow, you know.
Yeah,
but,
and it was all ours. It wasn't, you know, tourists from, you know, the moon.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
was like just people, and there was nobody taking pictures. People were just sitting around and, you know, having a drink or having a, you know, a sandwich, and just some people laying in the field or just walking around.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a different feeling. But Stonehenge is like...
It's on this tourist trail, you see, it's on the map, isn't it? Everybody
yeah.
who comes to England, they do a certain amount of things, five things, and, you know, and that's one of them, along with Buckingham Palace and,
ticking a box,
you know, and
yeah.
Shakespeare Country
yeah.
and, you know, and all that.
Maybe they've added, they've added an extra stone to Stonehenge, which is actually a phone mast. You wouldn't get a signal there,
the only problem I had since I've been to Liverpool was I had an argument with him. He keeps trying to set up a luncheon with the Queen, and I told him I'm definitely that's no man.
You
that's
know
what
we're connected on.
Yeah.
yeah.
And I told him I can't feed into that. Or did you say some queens? Oh, I thought it was the queen. He wants me to have lunch with some queens. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm sure you have enough of them here, but we have them in New York too. A lot of queens, but not the lizard type, not the lizard family.
You know this guy.
And they have a clothing line called Naughty Gear. So I photographed all his clothes said Naughty, and she's only 17. And until later, I didn't realize that I'd hit a gold mine. And one thing I didn't like, because I have a daughter, is that she's changing clothes in front of me. I said,
mm-hmm.
there's the dressing room. She said, I'm comfortable. I said, but I'm not. And, you know, I guess some models, they just dress and undress in front of you. And an adult, I don't care. A child in the room.
Mm.
And I was really surprised at that time how innocent she was, really innocent, you know, really sweet. And you know, just genuinely innocent. And we had a great time, and the pictures are very innocent. I even have a cowboy hat and everything. But the pictures are unlike anything other people have shot of her. And then another time, we were at Madison Square Garden. She was part of a show, a benefit or something. And, you know, a bunch of photographers, they're photographing her. And because we liked each other, you know, she'd always come over and give me a hug. To this day, she comes and gives me a hug. So I said, Brittany, I need some pictures of you a little bit different. She said, sure. And they had a thing there that picked up props. It's a machine, a forklift. And I had her driving the forklift and I'm taking pictures. So, you know, I had great, and Sinatra was a whole nother story. The people around him with no necks, you know, and you know, no photographers were allowed the whole doing, and I was using Jedi mind tricks to get these gorillas to let me in, because I told them I was working for them, and I kept saying, you don't want Mr. Sinatra to find out that because of you he didn't get these pictures taken.
Yes.
oh, you know, and these, you had to see them. I mean, they're centurions, you know, mercenaries. And finally, they, oh, okay. I said, you know, I'll call them. You know, you can talk. And I get in and get all these pictures. And after a while, they got, you know, used to me so I could get in. But they were, and I never called them Frank or Sinatra. I call them Mr. Sinatra. Automatically, they're burning. Yeah. So you wouldn't want Mr. Sinatra to be pissed off, would you? No. But, yeah, I did all of that. I actually had a session with Jimmy Carter, who turned out to be, I thought he would be cool, but he was just so beautiful and so spiritual. I mean, that was being, it was just me and him in a room. And, you know, I wasn't doing an interview, we were talking. I told him, I'm a photographer, whatever we say is between us. I don't write, you know, and all that. He said, oh, I don't care. You know, and we talked. And the irony of that is 2 weeks before, I was watching the news and he was talking. He had on the sweater. He was trying to tell America. He was trying to talk to America, talk with America. And he wasn't being presidential, he was being human. And he got roasted alive for that. And I told my wife, I said, you know, baby, ask Angela. He knows my wife. He can. I said, wow. You know, I have no love for presidents and the great white father, but that's a man I'd like to meet because I just got a feeling there's a spirit there. 2 weeks later, I get a phone call and I didn't recognize the caller. And they said, I pick up the phone. I said, hello, this is Ernie. They said, would you like to shoot the president? So I hung up the phone. My wife said, who's that? I said, phone rings again. Ernie, I said, yes, would you like to shoot the president? I hang up again. Phone again. Ernie, we want you to shoot the president first. So I hang up. I said, you know, then the phone rings again. And I said, yes. He said, Ernie, this is NBC where you work. Would you like to shoot a photograph, Jimmy Carter? You know. And I was so embarrassed because this is the liaison guy.
Yeah.
And I guess he realized how that sounded. Yeah. And I didn't recognize it. I didn't know him. And, you know. Do I want to? No, I don't want to shoot the president. I don't even want to be, I don't even want to have this conversation.
I'm pissed off, but not that pissed off.
You know, and whatever I do, I definitely don't want to be on record saying yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
your phone call will be recorded.
Yeah, so I was like, but then, and then sure enough, I met him, and there were all the Secret Service. We were just sitting on a couch, and he had to wait. He was going to be doing an interview. They had some other things going on. And he got there early. And I'm just sitting there and I was like, wow. And then a funny thing happened. I'm taking pictures of him and I planned everything, the film, the camera, the whole. And he looks at me and he's smiling, he's laughing. I said, what's the matter? He said, isn't the flash supposed to be going off? I had to turn on the flash. So I got these great pictures of him. What a dumb shit. I didn't even have, you know, you're in the, you know.
Yeah. God, I'm seeing that. I always thought he was quite a nice character. I mean, I remember when he was in power in America, I always thought he was a nice, one of the nicer American presidents. And it was good to see him, you know, back on the television and talking again when Obama was standing for president. It was nice to see him again because you forget what a real gentleman.
You know what he did after he left his presidency?
No, no.
You don't know?
No, no.
All the other presidents made it. Bill Clinton, I think, made $125,000 per lecture. Jimmy Carter has devoted his life since the presidency to Habitat for Humanity, where people take, you know, and they build homes for people.
Yeah.
And not only has he been involved with it, but he's actually been there all day cutting wood and putting. So he's dedicated his life to helping, which is in keeping with the essence of the Christian religion, the essence, not the Pope, the robes, but with the essence of feeding and clothing and sheltering people, and that's how he's devoted his life. He's done books, he's made his money, you know, he was wealthy to begin with, he didn't need that, but he's devoted his life to helping others.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine having a house and you said, Jimmy Carter helped build this.
Yeah. No, he was always a good president.
My wife is, you know, my whole family went out to vote for Obama, and, you know, myself included, even though I knew better. But my wife even now excuses him in saying that he is a figurehead. He sets a tone, he sets a tenor, and that he is doing the best that he can within the confines. But, you know, she's more forgiving and more tolerant. I don't see him as a bad thing, other than that it makes people lazy and more apt to figure, oh, everything's okay, Skippy, you know. Mm-hmm. And the truth is quite the contrary. And I don't see him as a bad thing, but I don't see him as a good thing either. As a matter of fact, there are those who call his reign Bush 2 or Bush 3, whatever.
Really?
Yeah. He's his harshest critics are people of color.
Yeah.
And black folks. Of course, there's black folks that, you know, just because of his skin tone, they would love him. But the truth is, you have to, if you're going to govern, you have to set a tone, which he's doing, but you also have to have some action. So, I don't know.
Well, we're going to have to call it a day. I'm not going to ask you any questions about hip-hop simply because I don't know enough about it to even start going into it.
Well,
but tell me, what's your favourite colour?
Liverpool. What's the Liverpool colour?
Red.
Red. Red. Oh, red. He's an Evertonian supporter, you see.
I don't know. Some guys I know from London, some Tufts, they said the Liverpool colour is pink. I don't know.
Colour universal love.
He's a funny character, isn't he?
I'm really glad to be in Liverpool, and I have literally, I could do a book on Liverpool just on thousands of pictures I took.
Yeah.
And like I said, I bring a different thing here,
mm-hmm.
because it's all new. If I go to Japan, some people want me to go to Japan. I've been dying to go to Japan.
Are you sure it's cute?
Yeah.
I'd have to come as well.
I'm just trying to get somebody to sponsor me to go there. But if I go to Japan, I'd bring a different, and not that standard alternative imagery I see, but I would bring a different eye. And, you know, there's no one in Japan that would have my eye because I'm new.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I come to Liverpool, I come with a different look. You guys come to New York, you'd see things that I've seen my whole life that I wouldn't even look at. I don't just mean the touristy things, but just things in general. When Mike was there, he was saying, you know, that's just the idea of fresh eyes when you go somewhere new. And especially if you go with an open mind and, you know, somebody that's from here that's showing you things, and then you have the ability to document things, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah,
and, you know, I don't
know. Who would do the book? Who's going to publish the book? You've done it.
Publish myself.
Yeah.
Self-publishing. It's like doing your own music now. Now you can do your own thing.
Yeah, we'll be able to see these pictures.
Yeah. Well, you can see them in Mike's house. Mike has. I've downloaded them to
load of memory cards now.
You've filled up your whole disk.
We've got three discs so far. We've only got two cards, and there's four more cards to do.
Right.
So.
To get a whole.
Yeah.
Hard disk.
If you want to put this into the report, this is where I have 9 books.
Ululu.com.
Mm-hmm. And www stands for Wild Wild West. and 2 of the books, one is called Deeper, and it's all capital letters. So if I say it's deeper, with my taste, you know it has to be something else. And the other one, even though people probably can't spell my name, they can spell the name of the books and look them up. The other one's called The Truth.
Mm-hmm.
These are 2 of the 9 books. I have 9 books there. And my classic book that sells all over the world that I no longer get royalties from is called Who Shot You? And the reason I don't get royalties is because I was smart enough as a first-time author to demand a large advance.
Mm-hmm.
Beforehand, so I'll never see a royalty because I got so much money. Rupert Murdoch, you're a good man. But Rupert Murdoch sent a memo that he did not want my essay in there on the colonization of hip hop, period.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. And they all these lackeys called me and told me. And I told them, I said, good, then you have no book. But we've already given you some of your advance. I said, yeah. Well, that's just for having the pleasure of speaking to me. And I hung up. And then they went to my co-author and they badgered him. And my co-author called me, he was panicking. He said, look, they let us choose the title, let us choose the pictures. They gave us complete autonomy. And they're saying that the essay on the colonization of hip hop has nothing to do with the nature of the book. And I said, well, let's make a deal. Okay, I believe in compromise. Let's take out the picture, the title, everything, just do the essay. He said, you're fucking crazy. I said, no, we'll just do the essay. He said, so I said, look, I got enough money. I don't care. I've lived 55 years without a book. I don't care, but I'm not going to do it without that essay. So a week later, the phone rings, and he says they've agreed to publish the essay. So I said, I knew that. Because once they've invested the money. But then I got screwed anyway, because out of 10,000 people that have read it, and I've gotten emails from around the world and letters, nobody mentions the essay, they all mention the pictures. And the essay is the core, it's the key to understanding the colonization of our minds, our lives, everything. But people don't read anymore. Mm-hmm. So everybody likes the pictures. So Rupert Murdoch gets the last laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And he always will. They might take in bits at subliminal level.
Yeah, they might do, yeah.
Creep in there, yeah, eventually. People might learn to read again.
It's quite odd, isn't it? Because there has been a real upsurge in the number of books being published and supposedly the number of books being read. Therefore...
No. Books purchased and books read are two different things.
Yeah.
It's like buying 50 CDs. You don't listen to all of them. And... if you have conversations, I have conversations, they call them lectures, but I have conversations, and you can tell by the looks and by the questions that my frames of reference, even the non-arcane ones, are pretty much lost on them. And the way you can tell the general intelligence of a room is by their understanding of frames of reference. I don't mean arcane, mysterious,
mm-hmm.
underground, subliminal. I'm talking about general, like when I mentioned Fahrenheit 451,
mm-hmm.
and he said he had read the book, and that's not that arcane.
Mm-hmm.
And there was even a movie. That's not some mystical hidden, and 100 other things that are frames of reference. And the less you read, the narrower your frame of reference. And there are people that don't even read the papers. There are people that don't know anything except their last tattoo or their tip piercing or something.
Mm-hmm.
So we're an endangered breed. Those who read, and it's number of books sold doesn't mean anything. And I was in the mall over here and the bookstores are closing. In Jersey City, the last bookstore is closed in the whole city.
Mm-hmm.
The last bookstore has closed. Jersey City is a large city.
Yeah.
They don't have one standing bookstore.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
It's true. Mm. Nobody mentioned it, but I see it. Mm. And if I need books, guess where I get books? I get them off Amazon.
Yeah.
You all done, Skippy?
Great. Can we just take a photograph?
Oh, only if you insist.
Thanks for downloading from DefNet Media.